Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's February 23rd, 2020, and welcome to episode 208 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, more first jobs, errata, and BBSing, and all the sort of fun stuff from your retro computing youth. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and joining me today are two retro computing enthusiasts. The first is Carrington Manston from Toronto. How are you?
I am excellent. Glad to be here.
Fantastic. And then
also that.
And also that, yes. And also joining us from Northern Virginia is Blake Patterson.
What?
How are you?
Hello. Very glad to be here. Very glad to be here.
Yes. So now Carrington has nothing to contribute to the show notes because he only read your things.
I was scrolling down in the show notes and seeing a lot of feedback from some dude named Blake.
Yeah.
Like, oh, who's this guy?
Oh, yeah, I was thinking, actually, I was going to hand off some of that now that you're here. I had taken notes for all of the things you wrote in about, and now we can discuss them directly.
If you write in enough, we force you to be on the show. Blake is here by court order.
Yeah, I did see a few of the items. I thought, huh, look at that.
It might be a different Blake. You don't know.
That's true.
So, last time Carrington and I talked about our first computer jobs.
Yes, indeed.
And I think we may still come back to that. Maybe we'll have that being a rolling topic for, you know, as soon as everybody shows up, we will have them talk about that. So I think, did you even want to talk about the first computer job, or do you want to just do the BBS?
Yeah, I want to hear it.
Well, I mean, it's very short. I guess I could just say what that is and then get that out of the way.
Okay, so we'll have two. We'll have a double-barreled topic this time.
Okay, mine is much less exciting. I think I was doing computery things ever since, you know, like 1982, but not really for pay, I guess. I volunteered to hang out after school and do some spreadsheet stuff with some of the teachers just to get time on the Apple II before we had a proper lab, that kind of thing. And of course, you could play games afterwards and all that. But I guess really unexcitingly, the first thing was when I had a Mac, I had an original Mac for like a week, and then I returned it because of strange reasons involving an Amiga. But at any rate, it was a Mac LC, so I guess a more modern Mac in college. And with the StyleWriter, you know, the first time we were really seeing the high quality non-laser print, that was kind of a new thing, really, for most of us, with TrueType and all that. I put up flyers in the library, and I would do page layout, like typing, that kind of thing, like page layout typing for people that were working on projects. But the thing that got me was I had to stop because people would hand me their document, and I would see these grammatical errors, and I would see spelling errors, and things that were worded like I would have totally worded them very differently. And so it became too painful. I'm not very OCD. Yes, I'm not really all about that, but I just could not do it. I couldn't type these things if there was something that was straight up just poorly, like, you know, grammatically incorrect. And so I would I did a few and I had to stop because it was driving me insane. And you can't actually correct it because that's, you know, college. I guess you could. That would have been another.
That's where you and I differ.
That could have been an additional fee. But no, so I stopped that. And then I guess I ended up with, after college degree, I ended up with a career job, which was network admin stuff. So, although I did that only briefly. I'm a developer for most of the career. So anyway,
all your jobs have been really tech related, like from the beginning.
I blew some leaves as a teenager, and I worked for at a sporting goods store for a Christmas break to buy a guitar. But other than those little stints. Right after college, it was like 2 years of network admin stuff, and then I decided to become a web developer, and I've been a web developer since. And of course, blogging mainly for fun on the side, a little bit of pay here and there, but not often. So, yeah.
Excellent.
Anyway, I guess so.
So I suppose anytime we talk about GIFs, then we probably should not have you edit the podcast that we talk about those in.
Maybe not.
I didn't take the bait.
You see me twitch.
We had another topic suggestion from RC2014. I'm not actually sure who is behind that Twitter account. But the question was, I thought this was kind of an interesting one to think about, or talk about at least. Why would anybody BBS now that we have the internet? So, which I think, I think that's an interesting question. Both for now and also for like 1993, right? Mm-hmm. When there was kind of a BBS crash, like pretty dramatic BBS mm-hmm. crash when, suddenly everybody had the internet and nobody called these BBSs anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly it crashed in my own activities, absolutely, like once mm-hmm. there was FTP. But maybe we could sort of go around and talk about that a little bit. And Blake, do you actually just recently, you've been doing a fair amount of like retro BBSing, so maybe you could start.
Yeah.
Why do you do this?
Yeah, explain yourself, Blake.
I'm seeing a counselor for help on this. She's advising me to back away from the terminal. But no, it seems a very. Given that there are Telnet BBSs out there today, and there are, there's a Telnet BBS list is the website. And if you look at it, it's the slowest site I've ever seen. I think it's actually running on a retro computer. I don't think that was part of its angle, but very slow. But there are hundreds of Telnet BBSs out there. A few of them have dial-up as well, which is, so if you're a person who has, vintage machines, a way to, use them, a very easy way to use them, given that most of the systems have a serial port, is to, to telnet in to one of these systems. The people that want to take it further, and involve an actual modem and attempting to have that work without some sort of moire pattern in the digitizing of audio on a VoIP line can dial in, and I guess that adds deeper satisfaction. I've only found frustration in that attempt. I've only attempted it a few times. I'm fine with the telnet, but it's also sort of a community that feeds on itself, because when you go there, the subject you're discussing is vintage computers, or maybe online games. They still have door games, do you remember the BBS mm-hmm. door games and the MUDs and everything? So people are talking about playing them. They're actually playing them. They're talking about the computers that they're dialing in on. Even it's sometimes as simple as, hello, I just pulled out this computer that's been in the closet for 20 years. I dialed in. See you later, and then they'll never appear again. But there are discussions, and there are regulars. Some of them overlap on Twitter. Some you only see on there. You're not aware of what their other social circles are, and it's fun. It definitely feels like a more of a focused community in that regard than say Twitter, because I don't know if it's necessary that because fewer people are seeing it, it feels like, you're having more of a you know, meaningful conversation. It's hard to really put a finger on, but the people that are involved in the conversation have taken this significant extra step to be able to be part of it. And and for me, like, I like to jump around on different machines. I've got, I put up a little BBS, like a page that kind of introduces people to how the hell they could do this. And I have a little video and describe what it is that I, you know, what machines I do it on. And I've got probably eight or so systems now that I just rotate between, you know, and it's nice to, you know, like, oh, what do I feel like, which system do I feel like using right now? Like, you know, I've got the Apple IIe, which has a nice, you know, sharp screen. I've got my GS, which is color, but a little hazier screen. And then the Amigas, of course, you can, you know, play mod music while you're on online. And, you know, it's, and sometimes you want to go for the oldest machine. So it's fun. Definitely the, you know, the journey, like, you know, making the connection and typing on the systems and looking at the screen, you know, and how it renders the, you know, the different color effects on the BBSs, which a lot of them have. That's, you know, that's part of the fun, aside from what it is you're talking about. And maybe that's more of the fun in certain, you know, sometimes. But yeah, so that's it. It's definitely something that I guess it's what I do most on the vintage machines, more than like gaming and more than, you know, well, I mean, I guess I update capacitors when I need to, but that's not really fun. But and that's becoming more and more. But yeah, so it's just a good... I think it's, I'd encourage someone, you know, who has a couple of retro computers, you know, to actually, you know, give it a try, because, you know, finding that cable and, you know, wiring things up and maybe, you know, having to figure certain things out is a nice little exercise. But yeah, do either of you ever Telnet into BBSs these days, or?
Telnet, yes, but not using a vintage computer. I mean, I've... Mm-hmm. Use SyncTerm, which is
yes, because you certainly don't have to use it. You certainly don't have to use a vintage computer. SyncTerm gives you the emulation for everything. It'll Atari, Commodore, all the IBM, and I do use SyncTerm on my, you know, on modern systems. So it's not that I only do it on the vintage machines.
I've yet to do it on a vintage. I haven't been on a BBS with a vintage computer since the vintage computers weren't vintage, and I was just on BBS.
Right. Gotcha. Okay.
I don't think I know SyncTerm, actually. What is this? Is it just a monitor one of the two, emulator?
I mean, if you're on a Mac, like, SyncTerm's probably... I mean, you can just tell that using the terminal, sure, of course. But terminal. SyncTerm's like a better, really a BBS terminal program. There's also a ZOC or ZOC or however it's pronounced, which I think is another popular one, but I haven't used it.
I've heard of it. I haven't used it.
Yeah, SyncTerm is what everybody seems to use. It's also for Windows, for a bunch of things.
Yeah, it runs on it's for Windows, for Linux, for the Mac, and I know there are people that you and I both I think follow on Twitter who've compiled it for like a bizarre flavor of Unix, like on a, you know, on a propeller or a Raspberry Pi like thing, and it works out. You can just compile it, the source code is out. It's open source, but it has emulations for all of the. It has like the PETSCII, it has the ATASCII for the Atari. It's got, you know, different variations of the IBM extended character set. So really, you could dial into anything, and with this one free program.
Yeah, that's why I stuck with it, because you used it and it seemed to just work. Like, I was on a site and it turns out it was like a Commodore 64 thing. It's like, here's a bunch of fonts, and it just worked. An Atari thing, it just worked.
Yeah.
So because of that, I was like, okay, I'm done. This is just very seamless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice. It's very nice. But
I'll grab the site and we'll throw a link to it in the show notes in case anybody else is interested.
Mm-hmm. Great. I do remember you mentioned the Paul. I'm pointing at the different. I'll stop doing that. Like, all right, Paul.
Yep.
I do remember the crash that you mentioned, because, you know, we were just BBSing back in 92, 93. That was what happened. I was on BBSs all the time. And then one local company offered a PPP dial-up service, you know, so you could access TCP/IP. And I had a Windows 3.1 machine, and it was the company's name was Widowmaker, appropriately, because his wife claimed that, you know, that was it once he started the company. And I think that applied to a lot of the people that dialed up. But yeah, once you had the ability to run a browser over your, you know, I guess at that point it was like a 28.8 modem line, I basically stopped calling BBSs almost like that. And, and I, you know, that was it. And I think that happened with everyone. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, a year later, cable internet, and then that was, well, you know, that was it.
Yep. Yeah. Exact same experience here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. You mentioned, you know, that the people that you talk to on these PBSs that you visit, you know, the message boards and stuff are, generally speaking, all people who have taken that step, which I guess that's true. It sort of self-selects. Like, you know that one thing that all of you have in common is that you have done this crazy thing.
Yeah. Right. Right. If you're able to have done this, and again, you can use SyncTerm, and but still, even using SyncTerm, you found the BBS, and you know you have an interest in it. But especially if you're, and people usually will, like, in their when they're signing out, as they sign the email, they usually mention what system they're dialing in on. Mm-hmm. You know, just for, you know, because it changes around, and yeah, you know automatically that. All right, this person knows what they're talking about. sort of. And yeah, that now that I vocalized that, and you underscored it, does seem to be a big part of it. I mean, maybe their BBS is out there about gardening. You know, I've not seen them. You know, it could be that there are people that have all this to say about gardening, but they're very upset about the fact that there's such a burdensome, you know, path to get to this gardening conversation. They just wish there was another alternative instead of BBSing to talk about gardening. But I haven't seen such a BBS.
Right. So I have dialed in a couple times. I have one of the first, I forget what it was called, but I have one of the early, it's a serial to Wi-Fi connector. So basically, you know, I forget what it's called.
Wi-Fi 232?
That is it. Yes. That was the first one, I think. And I think,
yeah, that was the first, yeah, Paul, Paul Rick Rickards, yes. Made it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was a really nice go-to, and it's long been not available, but there's others. And,
right.
I try to track those on this, that little intro page I have. I update it to see where you can get these devices, but they move around.
Yeah.
But yeah, but go ahead.
Yeah, So I got one of those, and I have gotten a couple of the sort of like more recent things as well, but I haven't tried them. But I did, so I succeeded in connecting an Apple III to some telnetable BBS. And that was kind of fun. You know, it was kind of cool to see that work. And it's cool that you can update the firmware, you know, with an AT command and stuff.
Yeah. 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 It's, I mean, you know, you turn it on and it's sort of an anachronistic experience of, you know, I've got the Apple IIe over here and it, you know, and it pops up, and as the screen is you know, glowing into its full luminance, you see the device itself shows you ... as it's negotiating with your Wi-Fi network, and it names the Wi-Fi network and gives you like signal strength, and you're like, this is strange. I'm seeing this on, you know, an Apple II from 1983, and yeah, but
I guess, yeah, so. I've periodically tried and failed to kind of get into BBSing. Like I would go, I would see, you know, that, well, first of all, yeah, I mean, essentially, I guess I just don't have, I haven't had the patience. Like there's, the nostalgia hasn't grabbed me enough, and the community hasn't been, I hate to blame the community for it, because I think that may be not fair, but maybe I'm just not looking at it correctly, but it sort of feels kind of lonely
there. Okay.
I mean, it's the same kind of problem I think there is with trying to resurrect these large online communities where, you know, like people used to play games and walk around and chat in places. And then, you know, mm-hmm. now that you've resurrected it, there are three people who come in, mm-hmm. you know, every third day.
Well, that gives you that No Man's Sky experience. Yeah. I like that.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
But,
Yeah, it's. I think one way I've avoided this, because I am aware of a great many different sites, and I wanted to log into a number of them to see, you know, some of them run, you know, various, you know, BBS software like Synchronet or what have you, and you know that they're very visual, like they're going to have a lot of the color IBM PC based, you know, ANSI graphics. Some of them are. You know, they have some BBSs that run a bizarre, not bizarre, but sort of not frequently encountered protocol. There was a terminal program on the Apple II called ProTerm, and it let you use the sort of the high ASCII mouse text mm-hmm. that the extended Apple IIe and the 2C and GS have to do animations and things. And there are BBSs that run that. So you kind of want to see the different ones, but I've I have intentionally narrowed my list down because the ones that I dial into regularly are is maybe like five, mm-hmm. four or five. And the reason I did it was noticing what you're talking about, because some of these things, like one BBS, for instance, it actually continues the FidoNet feeds. Like these are, you know, FidoNet and RetroNet. Yeah, it still happens. So you post something on there, and then a few days later, it has made the rounds, and then people are responding from far away, all the way across the country. You know, it's amazing, amazing technology. They didn't even have to dial long distance. It's a tech that's not quite as important as it once was, that whole relay system. But, you know, and then there's like my main go-to, I guess, is the not plugging here or there, but there's one called the Level 29, which is associated with a subreddit on Reddit dealing with retro computing. And, you know, that is every day there'll be maybe, 30, 40 new messages, which is pretty good in my book. And that keeps you going in a conversation. I mean, it's frequent enough that I can log in and say, I've got this. I'm trying to get a modem working on the Cocoa 3. I'm having serial port issues. Has anyone seen this before? Does it sound like something? And I will get a response like later that night or in the morning or something like that. And that's, so it's actually, you know, practical for even problem solving in that self, you know, supporting area. Mm-hmm. I'm
pretty sure that I have that. Level 29 was probably the place that I called to.
It's very basic custom software that it does its best, and it does certainly this was the intention. So it tries to determine what your system's capabilities are. Like it'll look fine pretty much automatically if you log in on like an 8-line 40-character, you know, laptop from before when there were laptops, you know, like a Model 100 or something. I think I used a Earl's favorite, the Epson, the PX8, the Geneva, and I think it automatically figured out that, well, this guy has only four or five lines of text, but I'm not going to say anything about it. I'm not going to give it a hard time. I'll just render it and, you know, support the page breaks and things like that. So that's a good one to start on, I think. And
I don't think I was trying to do a BBS thing, but I did get a PX8 talking to a Mac terminal at one point. I think actually, I followed a wire building schematic thing that you had posted yourself, actually.
Usually if I do something like that, I'll snap a picture of the extremely illegible scrawl that I've done on a napkin where I'm mapping out the two sides of the port and throw it up on Flickr. So I'm sure you might have seen that drawn in crayon or something. Yeah, good. I'm actually battling. That was an actual thing I'm trying to do. I'm having wiring and signal issues with the attempt to get a Cocoa 3 BBSing. So such a light machine, Carrington. It almost flies up into the air, as you point out, filled with helium and magic.
So I guess, Blake, you sort of referred to this, I think. But one thing that's kind of unfortunate now is that I think it's getting more and more difficult to actually like connect a landline phone to a computer and call a modem because everything is being digitally sampled. So
I think if you're doing it at a slow enough speed, like if you're, and again, like I think Level 29 automatically, if your terminal supports the features, it will slow you down to 2400 baud. Like it will only serve you letters at 2400 for effect, just for fun. If you're down with that, then I think, you know, you can picture what I'm saying when I say it's kind of like a Moore pattern of the two different digitized, you know, you've got a signal and then it's being recorded and then sent. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there'd be interference with 2400 or 4800. I think it will generally work if you have a VoIP line. I mean, I have successfully done it once from here in attempting that quite a few years ago. I believe it is the case that you can still, I mean, this you'd have to be going quite out of your way. I think you can still get a landline that is not digital. Like I believe, what is it, a PBX? I can't remember what the term is, But if you want to pay for it and have them install it, which really would put you as like the alpha geek, you know, way out there. You can, I think you can do that. So you could just run fully, but then I guess there'd have to be that on the other end. Well, no, it sort of hurts the head to think about, but yes, I think overall, if you're not sure, if you're willing to go, you know, slow, then you can do it. Usually, like when I see people try it, mm-hmm. I don't see a lot of failure messages. Like here and there, like, oh, it's not working, and someone will respond, oh, you just need to adjust this, and it should be fine. So, the level 29 is one of those BBSs that has the additional the dial in, and there's like I said, there's a few others out there, but I don't actually take that step, So,
I know that sometimes when I'm using. You know, even bulletin board software that I kind of was familiar with and used a lot back in the day, I do sometimes get struck by the fact that things have gotten better since then. These are actually a little bit hard to use, you know, trying to page through messages and figure out which ones are the new ones. And yeah, so.
Yeah, no, I mean, yes, you're right. It's easier and quicker to do these things, you know, in a forum or on a, but you know, it's definitely gives you an excuse to power up a machine.
Yeah.
You know, so as does, you know, not to get into a separate conversation, but like IRC, for instance, mm-hmm. like Internet Relay Chat, I have an Apple IIc on my desk at the office, and it is just, you know, one of the little terminal windows on a Raspberry Pi I've got hanging down the back of the desk is just routed to that, you know, without any special, that's still supported in Linux, you know, it's just serial terminal. And so I'll sometimes put that up as a background, just as a backdrop thing to glance over at. And I do IRCing, you know, on Windows in the, you know, Windows on my workstation in the terminal, but it's just kind of fun to see, or even like 2C has a certain smell when the CRT heats up. I kind of like that. I work in a cubicle, so I do anything I can to get the coziness back now that I'm not in an office as I always had been prior. So, you know, that's
pretty excellent.
It's fun. It's nice to have a reason to turn them on.
Well, I think, I mean, one other thing about BBSs that, at least, you know, the ones that did file transfer, is that they do, using them today does provide you with something like a native way to get software to them, right? I mean, like, you know, they know how, you know how to download a program from a BBS because that's how you did it back then. You don't know flashcards to worry about or.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you see, I mean, and you do see some download areas. I think a lot of BBSs that are out there today don't really bother with downloads because there's so many better ways to do it, you know. But some do, you know. I haven't spent a lot of time, you know, browsing through file libraries, or even playing the door games. They're out there, but I didn't do a lot of that when I was like back in the day, and I guess now is not the time I'm going to start doing that, I guess, but
I kind of wonder. So my own BBS experience there was definitely almost no door game stuff, although I did write, I wrote a little like role-playing game that people could play, but I never really played them myself.
How novel.
But what I was thinking about was that, you know, a lot of my experience was in the kind of like, you know, the semi-underground, you know, BBSs where everybody's talking about wares and, you know, whatever, phone codes and things. And that doesn't exist anymore. I don't think it would even be fun to talk about pretend phone codes.
Yeah. No, I think, it's that was the whole scene. And I guess that is the way the tech has changed. You just can't, no one cares about long distance, you know, there is no long distance anymore. And I knew some people that were definitely the phone freakers, you know, that were getting the codes and dialing up California to download the, you know, the wares and things like that. But I didn't have personal experience with the phone freaking.
And there was a whole hierarchy, you know, the people who just did the, you know, the war games thing and phone codes were lesser than the people who would, you know, like hack into mainframes or whatever.
Yes.
Those definitely the days, yeah.
And I think you mentioned a few episodes ago, there was the, what was it? It was a modem that, or a modem and a software package that together would allow double speed or something. Yeah. Like if you didn't need to communicate, what was
it? Yeah, it's the AppleCat.
Is that the AppleCat?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's possibly that maybe you just missed that era in the Apple II or whatever. Oh, well, and actually the two would have been useless for the 2C, come to think of it, because it required a slot or two. But but yeah, it's never, I have not ever quite understood why it was cheaper to do 1200 baud half duplex than full duplex. But it's, at any rate, this was special about that modem was it could do half duplex 1200 baud. And so if you did some sort of fancy negotiating, you could basically say, all right, I'm going to send you a file now, switch to 1200, and it would receive it and then switch back to 300 to get more commands. So
interesting. Yeah, I know I missed that. That was something, but yeah, I was in and out of the Apple II, I think, yeah, so.
But that was definitely you can see references to it, though, on a lot of the cracked games and things, you know, like the people's cat fur lines and stuff like that.
So. Yes, I think I can recall some of those, I think. I never really, yeah, I didn't put two and two together that was because it allowed easier, you know, downloading. I thought they were just had a fondness for a particular brand of modem, but I guess if it helped you distribute that where, then it gets a shout in the crack screen.
I think, yeah. I think the AppleCat users were pretty loyal too, because that was, I had one, I loved it, I was loyal to it, but it did a lot of stuff. I mean, so it did that, you know, the speed thing, but it also could decode touch tones, so you could command it, you know, it could listen to the line and figure out what you were typing to it. It had a voice synthesizer in it, I think, if you had the right chip.
It was extremely expensive, was it not?
I don't know. Kind of. I mean, I think it was more than the, what was the one? There was one Christmas when everybody got the networker.
Oh, right. Oh my gosh. I haven't thought of that in forever.
That was, and you know, so that was terrible because, you know, suddenly there were a bunch of, noobs.
Oh, those noobs with their network.
Noobs. Yeah. They'll wreck the party.
Yeah. But
the September that never ended.
But anyway, so yeah, the networker was a lot cheaper. I think, you know, it was like probably half the price of the AppleCat was.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I wish I'd felt that. It's too late. I just can't get that. I cannot experience that now. There's no way that I'll be able to live that thing. So that's fine.
Okay. It's possible now that we've been talking for a million years. We should maybe move off the topic because there are plenty of other things. I've been spending a bunch of time not quite getting around to editing the previous episode, and then what I figured I would do is edit the previous episode and then go look at the listener feedback. None of these things have happened. So I don't have a very elaborate list of listener feedback. And half of the listener feedback is from Blake. So,
yeah, sorry.
It was easier just to bring them on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so maybe I'll mention a couple of things and then maybe, you know, Blake, you can talk a little bit about the other ones too, but the
okay.
So we talked some number of episodes ago. There was a one of the eBay picks was a Thinkadot, which was this. It was billed as a computer game. Oh, it was a computer game, mm-hmm. and it is fun or something like this.
Yes.
Oh yes, I recall you mentioning it.
And it was something where you sort of like drop something through, and it sort of activates. You drop little marbles through or something, and it sort of activates switches that are hidden inside. But so the Sarnoff connection on Twitter tweeted us a link to, it's basically just a little article they wrote on the original Thinkadot prototype and a couple of other things by that same company that made these late 1960s computer-based games. So if you want to check that out, that is interesting to do. It's not very long, but it's kind of cool to see the original prototype and to see a little bit more about these games.
Oh, I hadn't actually seen this. This looks interesting.
Yeah.
Nice.
Last time we recorded, one of Carrington's news items was AppleArchive.org, which was this really nice, I say was.
You say get the tense right. Yeah, it was. You're correct.
So it was a big, people haven't heard that yet, now that I think about that.
Oh.
So soon on the feed, there will be Carrington talking about applearchive.org, and it was this nice, sort of by year, by topic, categorized, kind of indexed to, what I thought was just indexed to YouTube videos, but in fact, actually, it was more than that. I think the person behind it actually uploaded a bunch of stuff, got a Vimeo site, and it was costing a certain amount per month to do and so forth, but it's gone now. It just says like this site has expired, and
it's not a happy thing to see.
I think it was probably this sort of pinged to something with me as well, because just, I don't know, like a week ago or something, I got a couple of copyright strikes on YouTube for some older, they're sort of internal Apple videos of some kind, sales videos that I don't even remember anymore, but they were, you know, I had some VHS tapes. I digitized them. I posted them because I hadn't seen them anywhere else. And, you know, YouTube sent me a little thing saying, you have 3 strikes and this is the first of them. We have removed this video for you. And I bet, you know, my guess is that the Apple lawyers were around hunting for things. And it's quite possible that all the press contributed to that. But so it's possible that my YouTube.
Yeah, they may not be unrelated.
Yeah, exactly. So my copyright strikes may have been due to AppleArchive.org becoming
famous. Or the other way around. Maybe you're the fault.
Right.
You started the cascade and you took down Apple Archive. Way to go, yes. Paul.
However, I do think that we can't blame episode 207 for that, because it is still to come out.
Actually, everybody from Apple Legal watches our stream live on YouTube while we're recording.
That's probably it.
That's probably the case.
They're going to take down this video because I just said that.
Right. Okay, let's see. So, and then I'd transcribed a couple of things, Blake, that you had tweeted at us. You can probably see them here, but
yeah, I'm looking at them.
Okay, so maybe you can just sort of like walk through your thoughts on
that. Okay, sure.
I know they're like, whatever, 280 character thoughts, but whatever.
I guess I had responded to a number of different items over the last couple of shows. Mm-hmm. And yeah, one of them was, I don't know how it came up, the company Gorilla Banana. Do you remember how that came up in an earlier episode?
Oh, I think we were talking about Soft Talk, but it had to do with the ads, because these ads.
Yeah, the ad for it is particularly.
Yeah, they were everywhere.
Were they floppy disk ads? No. They didn't make floppy disks, did they?
I don't think so. I just remember seeing these ads all the time.
I remember. They were very distinctive.
They always bought like cover 2.
Yeah, they did. It was so as you, I think it was mentioned, and I don't recall what was, I think there was a printer, someone mentioned they had, might have been for a printer, and I was confirming that, yeah, I remember the printer ad, and I also remember they made a CRT, and it was the thing when I got my 2C in 84. They had a deal where you could get the Gorilla Banana CRT mono, cheaply for the time, like $99, which was cheap at the time for a CRT. But I wanted the little, you know, little 2C pretty monitor. So I passed on it. My parents were pretty happy with that deal, but I was explaining the industrial design and, you know, all of the, so passed on that.
And I think you made the right choice aesthetically, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, aesthetically, that's one of the best looking, I guess, systems, I think, around, as far as, I mean, it's in the Museum of Modern Art, didn't it? Or quickly end up in some famous accolades of design. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if that was Frog Design with that, or if that was.
I think the TC was Frog Design.
Yeah, TC was Frog Design. It was the whole Snow White thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they even made a very stylish wall plugging modem, if you remember that matched the 2C. Mm-hmm. It was a Frog Design modem. Anyway, let's see. Some other ones. It came up that there was a Atari XEGS was a console that was mentioned. Mm-hmm. The XEGS was Atari's take. I can't remember if it came with a. With the keyboard. I know it had a light gun, and I think it might have come with the keyboard, but basically you could run cartridge. It was like an Atari 65XE that was just spread out into different parts with pastel-colored buttons.
The color scheme is odd. Just great.
Yeah, it's like pink, light purple, yellow, strange. At any rate, what the thing that always comes to mind, my mind for when that comes up is this person, Boise Petrie, who's actually a big cocoa person in the cocoa community. Mm-hmm. He did this insane project that I remember when he announced he was going to do it. And I thought, well, surely that can actually happen. But he did it quickly. He just went to get an 8-bit Atari on eBay, and he happened to find XEGS, and he used that as his vehicle just because it was in front of him. And he took the 6809 processor, Motorola 6809, which is arguably the most powerful 8-bit processor out there. It's much more powerful than a 6502. But anyway, the 09 is very powerful. It has some 16-bit ops. Anyway, so he took that CPU, replaced the 6502 or the 6510. I can't remember the variant that the Atari uses. And wrote a ROM, and basically, because the Coco has all the CPU power, but it doesn't have any custom chips, and the Atari 8-bit computer has very impressive custom hardware. It was the predecessor of the Amiga, really, linearly. And he was successfully coded up a boot sequence. He wrote a couple of demos, graphics demos, where he's bouncing the Atari logo around with scrolling color lists, driven by the 6809. So theoretically, you could, if someone took that platform and ran with it, you could really do some impressive things with that combination. I think he did it as a experiment just to see if he could do it. He did it and he moved on. And I've never seen any other people like follow this. And, there's not like a new platform out there. But it's very fascinating. And I imagine we'll put a show note link to that project.
Sure.
That was one of the more impressive things I've seen.
It seemed to me like, I'm trying to recall this now, but it seemed to me like it was not, it wasn't entirely just a drop in. Like, you couldn't just get a 6809 and drop it in there and then run his software. Right? Like, there's a little bit more hardware involved.
Well, I mean, he does the ROM. I think physically, I believe that the 6800 is the 6800 not pin compatible with the 6502? Maybe there was more. Maybe he had to create a daughter board. That I don't remember, mm-hmm. actually. I'm just briefly looking through, in a quick scan, nothing's coming up. So I might not be remembering some of the details, but I don't think it was an enormous amount of adaptation. I think most of it was, kind of working the ROM, building a bootloader. And, but yeah, you may be right. Do you remember specifics about that?
No. Partly what I was thinking of was there's a little picture of a thing on a PCB, but I'm not sure if...
Okay.
Because it would be neat to try this. I know I had the same thought about coprocessor cards. I think we were discussing this at some point, but you can get fancy coprocessor cards for your, whatever computer you have, and then you can write software by yourself for yourself.
Right. Exactly. And you are the entirety of the target market.
Yeah.
Right.
So it would be kind of neat if it turned out that this was easy to do. I don't think it's that hard to find an Atari 8-bit computer, right? I mean, So, and it's kind of a neat project, actually, to pair the sort of more powerful support with the more powerful chip.
Right, right. And actually, now that I'm looking, at my own article that I wrote about this on the blog. It's even more elegant than I was recalling. He created and initially it was a wire rack prototype, of course, but he had a board printed, which I wonder how many of them there are or were, but basically it houses both the 6809E from the Coco and the 6502C, and you can switch between modes. Oh. So you can actually so you can just decide what you want to boot into, and he's actually booting it into the highest end OS for the Coco is improvement on OS 9. It's called Nitro OS 9, however you want to pronounce it. And he successfully can boot all the way into that. And I know it has, it's not a default piece, but it does have some little basic GUI stuff. So presumably he's having that, but running, I guess, with Atari graphics hardware. It's interesting. Yes, so it's more elegant than I had. And actually, you are able, or at least you were able, to order that board as I read more of my article, which I remember nothing about. Look at all the information here. You could order that board for $65. So basically, for $65, you could go grab a you could grab an Atari and do this.
Well, supposedly, I don't know about that source.
Yeah, he's a little shoddy. But I have never seen people like on the forums, Atari Age, that kind of thing. I haven't seen a lot of people do this. I've never seen like demo scene productions that are based on this. I'm going to have to dig into it now. That's interesting.
No, it seems like it would be kind of a fun project. And, you know, at least as rewarding as writing, you know, for a 68,000 add-on card for an Apple II or something like that.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I would agree.
I'm pretty sure, actually, I do have... certainly they exist. There are 68809 cards for the Apple II. I think the Stellation the Mill one was one of those. So you can... It's possible to do something sort of similar, although then what you're doing is coupling a more powerful processor with kind of crappy support.
Right.
Yeah, I guess you could go in any direction you want. You could try to... Maybe you could find the weakest processor and the weakest hardware and just see how bad you can
spiral
make
down
for yourself. Right. But, yeah. Yeah. Hey, I see this just a couple. There's two more items. I'm going to skip a couple, there's two more that I had mentioned that. So you were talking about the earlier in an earlier episode, the clock. And I don't remember how this came up. Do you remember, Paul? I'm looking at the clock speed of the Amiga. Do you remember how we talked about this? Why this was
well, yeah, I think up? So. All of this stemmed. This we're coming on like 6 months of talking about this, I think, probably. But all of it stemmed from, I think it was WASFest picking
up. Why it was called what it was called.
So, it had to do with kind of like the clock speed that drove NTSC and a bunch of other stuff in the Apple II and the PAL version that the European ones had.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so you had mentioned something about the Amiga's choice of clock speed being very sensible.
The Amiga, the reason that it runs at a very specific, in North America, it runs at 7.15909 megahertz, which is, very precise and a slightly shifted number for PAL. And the reason was that it was, the precisely double the NTSC video color carrier frequency. So they were able to create a very cheap, it's like a $99 Genlock device that allowed for video overlay because there was no need for any sort of syncing, you know, any arbitrary syncing. I remember that was one of the things that got the Amiga into, you know, some of the local, you know, news and PBS, public broadcasting titling.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I mean, that was before the video toaster, but still, it was seems like a move that got them some little bit of market share, even if it's niche.
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned that it's before the video toaster, but of course, that's the platform the video toaster was on.
Yes. The video toaster, right. Well, the Amiga 1000... it would have taken some real work to get a video toaster wired onto that thing. But when after the, in 87 or 88, when the 2000 came out, because the Amiga 1000 was 85, so the toaster came out in like 89, maybe, 1989. But once you're at the toaster, I think it didn't, it wasn't feeling the benefit. I mean, it was doing its own thing. So, I don't think that there had been, I don't believe that the designers of the Amiga were aware that, you know, somebody was going to, you know, there weren't talks about, okay, we're going to build this device, you know, down the road. I think it just happens to, you know, have been both for broadcast benefit.
Interesting. So. Yeah, you perfectly anticipated the question I was going to ask.
No. And, all right, just to get my last one off of there, I obviously spend too much time responding on Twitter to the podcast episodes. You mentioned Detect Grounded was mentioned, and again, I'm trying to remember what it was that I was responding
sure,
to.
Sure, I can fill the back part up because that actually sort of fits into what we were talking about before here, that DTAC Grounded made a 68,000 add-on board basically for an Apple II. It was like a development system. And at the time, I'd been sort of talking about that same problem. Like, you know, you could write something for it, but then who would run the thing? You're right. It would be just you, right? So, and they're super expensive.
Right.
And
sure.
We talked on Drop 3 Inches, we talked a little bit with Don Burtis, who advised them you know, DTAC grounded on this. But I didn't until your response here, I did not know really what they were. I mean, like, so this was what you were about to say, I guess, is actually it's sort of much more than I thought they did.
Yeah, apparently they were, I guess it was a newsletter, I guess an organization, and they put out a newsletter. And I think we have an example link, and it covered what was, well, I guess the reason, the thing that I became, that brought me into awareness of them was there was a basic interpreter for the Atari ST called DTAC or DBASIC from DTAC Grounded. And I remember I thought, what an odd name. And I looked up DTAC Grounded and read that it was, you know, the line out of the CPU going to ground. And it was extremely high performance. It was a hand-tuned assembler, was used for the interpreter, and it didn't compile the BASIC. Like, it was actually interpreting it, but it was unbelievably fast. I think it was a competition with, you know, just counting numbers and displaying them. It was orders of magnitude, like three orders of magnitude faster than Atari BASIC or something like that.
Holy moly.
But it didn't, I've never heard mention of it again since I used it and had it. And I think it actually had the newsletter that they put out, it had a electronic version of that basically on the disk, I remember. Mm-hmm. And, but yeah, it never went anywhere though. That was, you know, that was the end of it, I think.
That is funny, you know, having experiences like that where there's a thing and it was important to your life because you used it a lot and, you know, you were well aware of it, and turns out nobody else heard of it.
Yeah. And if it was just, you know, user group, it was that we had a user group BBS, and like people would upload things that they'd found, and this was on that. And we talked about it a little bit at one of the BBS meetings for the Atari back in like 86 or 87. And so a few of us were using it, and but then, yeah, it just never encountered it again, never saw mention of it again.
There was something that, it reminds me a little bit of an experience I have with something. It was a variant of BASIC called Better BASIC, and it was stylized like all one word, you know, better normal caps and then BASIC in capitals by Summit Software. And it was a PC program, and I wrote a lot of stuff at work in Better BASIC. I don't know if I may well have mentioned this before, but it's just not out there. I mean, like, you know, I left work for college, and I'm sure the place that I worked threw all the things away, and those might have been almost the last ones, because it was nice, but it was a very small user base.
I've not heard of it.
Yeah,
me neither. Nope.
I've been looking. You know, I've had a standing search on eBay, and it has not shown up. I have somewhere, I got a demo disc, you know, maybe 3 years, 4 years ago or something, which is, you know, so it wasn't actually Better BASIC itself, but it was from the company. It said Better BASIC on it, and it sort of like demonstrated why you would want to buy it. You know, it was distributed at computer shows or something. Mm. So I have some evidence that it existed. Not just faulty memory.
How many standing searches do you have on eBay, Paul?
I have a lot. I don't know. Actually,
not a lot.
I think the iOS app just got updated, and then one of the update points they said was that I think you can have now 200 or something. So I don't.
Oh, so you can have more now.
Yeah, but I don't have that many. It's, you know, whatever. I actually should start deleting some of them because I have the thing that they were searching for.
Yeah, everything I have that was standing search I've acquired, and I never took it off, so I get alerted to it, and I was like, "Oh, look, I could have gotten this for $10. Exactly.
I could have saved money.
Yeah, that's
that one's cleaner. Maybe I need another one. Or yeah.
Well, I think I've said this before, but there is a temptation if you see a cheap one, to just get it so that it like lowers your average cost.
But yes, I understand the sentiment.
Let's see. So I think I don't want to spend too much more time on the feedback, but one thing George wrote on Twitter asking about 206, which is the 1-2 ago, what was with the ringing bell? I added a bunch of dings in there, but basically just every time somebody said something that seemed kind of like a joke. I think this was when, I think probably when Earl made the New Year's resolution joke and stuff, he got a little ding.
I think I got a ding when I mentioned my girlfriend who lives in Canada. Yes, you did. Totally a real thing.
Yes.
Totally real. You wouldn't know where she lives in Canada.
Right.
It's basically the RCR drinking game. Whenever you hear the bell,
right. Take a drink. Take a drink, yeah.
Okay, anyway, yeah, so maybe I'll mention one more thing just because I'm looking at it now.
Sure, we're now in. Let's see. Right.
So Michael wrote over email saying that Earl likes to play with Forth and Techmoan. I don't know Techmoan, but I think it's a well-known YouTube channel.
YouTube poster, yeah. He's the guy that buys everything. Like, I don't know where he gets the money to fund, like, everything. These European audio, ancient audio things, but it's impressive, yeah. He's a YouTube guy. Cool. YouTube channel.
Yeah. A guy named Matt, I think.
All right. So, and I think this. I think the Forth connection is only, it's a little bit incidental. Like, it wasn't something that was featured on the Techmoan channel very much, but so the guy just did a video on the Wiki Reader, which is, it's basically a pocket offline Wikipedia. So the idea is that you put in a little flashcard and it contains Wikipedia without the pictures, just the text, and then you can look stuff up without having an internet connection. So this was released in 2009.
It brings back, it feels like it should be called an encyclopedia or.
Yeah. Well, but more, a little bit more updatable than. I think that was kind of the idea. Like, you don't update your 20 volume.
Just anachronistic. What if it was, imagine a Wikipedia, but it's not plugged into the internet and you can hold it in your hand or put it on your bookshelf.
Yeah. But I think it was 2009. I mean, I guess that the iPhone was still like. The iPhone was earlier than that, but
2007.
Yeah, so it's a weird thing. I don't think it's survived very well. It was initially at $99. It claims to run 12 months on 2 AA batteries, and it uses a microSD card for its data. And there was a time when there was just a total fire sale on these, you know, so that you could get them for $15 or whatever. I've been looking a little bit since then. And I think the demand has gone back up for these because they're like this weird, weird thing from the olden days.
Right.
Is it an e-paper display?
Looking at it, I would assume so.
I don't think it is, though. I think I think it.
How does it last so long then?
Oh, I think it lasts so long because you have to turn it off.
Because you don't use it. Because you use it once to go. Well, that sucks. Yeah.
Because it looks a lot like a Palm Pilot actually in its screen. But
yeah, I like the look. I'd never seen it before, but it has a, now I kind of want one.
Yeah, I know, me too. But so the other thing, the reason that it made it into our feedback was that it actually also runs Forth. Like you can upload a Forth program to it and it will run that. It has a little.
And it also plays Doom.
If you can write Doom in Forth.
Text, it's an ASCII version of Doom.
That'd be pretty cool.
You know, someone has written Doom in Forth somewhere.
Gotta be.
But yeah, so I think, you know, so there's a couple of little like example programs, but so what did Michael write here? So he said, Techmoan just did a video on the Wiki Reader, which has the interesting feature of running Forth programs. The included Forth programs seem to include test codes for the machines, and so it would give you probably samples of everything you can do with it. He does not expect that you can do development on the Wiki Reader itself, but, you know, you can put things on a card and then put those in.
Interesting. So, I never heard of this thing before.
Yeah, I think if it were still around for $15, I would get one or two for fun.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen them for much less than like, you know, 40 or something. And then that stops being, it has missed the sweet spot.
Right. Yeah, looking at some of the, at the angle in some of the shots of these eBay items for this device, that's a regular LCD. That's not e-paper. Mm-hmm. If it was e-paper, that would make it nicer.
Yeah,
be interesting to see how it does update. Like, is it that you can connect every once in a while and simply download all of Wikipedia? Because then I'd want to go on, make a whole bunch of radical changes, and then just download it and go, let's see what Wikipedia says. Oh, Earth is flat. Yeah. Says so here.
No, in fact, actually, the updates, you buy a new SD card. You can you can get a like the 2018 update or whatever. I think there actually is at least 2016 you can buy on the, I've seen on eBay.
Well, nothing much has happened since then, so it's all good.
Interesting. Never heard of it.
Yeah, I hadn't before we got this feedback, so I think that's pretty interesting. And I think I like the idea that it runs Forth. I mean, I think I could run Forth in many other ways, but this is kind of cool. Okay, we'll leave that feedback for that there. I think at some point I will go back and check in on the Facebook page and the emails and stuff like that. But there was actually more here than I realized, so it's good. And fortunately, Blake was here to voice his.
Okay. Yes.
So now everybody write feedback to Blake.
Excellent.
But okay, so now we can turn to the highly distinct area of the show called Items of Interest and News.
Very different. Very different.
And
switching gears.
Somebody has actually now beaten Carrington in the alphabetical race. And so, Blake, you are first.
Oh, well, they're alphabetical. I never realized that before.
Oh, you just thought you were always first?
No, I just think it was just whatever order things got entered in the first time, and we just copy-paste every time. It literally never occurred to me it was alphabetical.
Okay. Well,
I bet most of our listeners didn't realize it was alphabetical either. I can't be the only person who didn't notice
that. I did not realize it was alphabetical.
That's cool.
I did not realize.
Wow. Only took me 208 shows to realize. Okay.
I thought it was because, you know, I was first because I was the, you know, the odd man out
it's
here.
It's hazing.
Because you're the noob.
Yeah, the noob. Go but, first. But no, my name comes first. Now we need someone named Aaron or something like that. Okay, so sadly, it is the case that someone else, another historical tech giant, Larry Tesler, has died, sadly. Larry Tesler of Xerox PARC and later Apple. Yeah. Apple passed away at age 74 here in the last few days. It's interesting looking at the team. I mean, I've read a lot of books, the histories of Apple and you know, different history of the Mac and like Lisa and he always just I can't put a finger on, you know, specific quotes or even images. It's some of the things I've heard as well as some of the group photographs. But he always seemed like I always figured he was a very swell fellow. Like he always seemed like I don't know. He was just seemed like a very pleasant person from the accounts and you know, and from the imagery from the time with the guys together. But yeah, he has passed away. He was at Xerox PARC. He joined PARC, I believe it was in 73. And when he was at PARC, I just made some notes. He worked on the Gypsy word processor. He in their office system group, he was contributing to Smalltalk, which the...
Oh, cool.
Yeah, the object-oriented, I guess, the first, perhaps, object-oriented language.
I think of that as the first object-oriented, you know, language,
basically. Yeah, and it, you know, it was largely a basis for Objective-C, you know, which was the primary macOS development language, or probably maybe still is. And branching from that, there's an educational language platform called Squeak. I don't know if anyone has heard of that. It's
sort of recent, right?
Yes, yes. But I think that's very derivative of Smalltalk. Mm. I think it almost is like a superset of Smalltalk. But anyway, so he was contributed to object-oriented programming. He worked with a small group in nailing down some of the core pieces of graphical user interface. He and another fellow developed demonstrated and implemented the first cut and paste, which I think is mentioned. He may have, it looks like, coined the phrase user friendly in talking to people that were as relating to GUIs in talking to people explaining how computers are difficult to use. And he was there for both of Steve Jobs' famous visits to PARC. And in 79 and shortly after, I think it was 1980 that he joined Apple. And I always remember him as his role in the Lisa group. I know he was one of the core people on the Lisa team, and I actually was unaware of the fact that he had contributions to the Newton development afterwards, after that. That was something I hadn't known. And apparently he was involved with object-oriented extensions for the Pascal language that I guess Apple had that early Pascal, which was, I'm trying to recall, there was a famous poster. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, yeah. I think the one with the iron on. That would bleed onto all the pages nearby.
Oh, right, yeah.
Right, so I think that was the early Pascal, not the visual Pascal that came later. But anyway, his object-oriented earlier work, he was trying to, you know, implementing that with Apple Pascal to create Object Pascal. But at any rate, he has sadly passed away. It seems like it's frequent that there's such news on episodes of the show, but I guess that's how it works.
Yeah.
Yep. So it's, interestingly, everyone talks about him as the cut and paste person, like basically invented cut and paste.
Yeah, I think.
But his real passion, I think, was for non-modal stuff. Like he was all about don't make modal software. Don't like just that was the thing. Like, and I think that's what he brought to a lot of stuff is, you know, don't do modal software. It's all on Twitter. He was at no modes. Like I was like very passionate about non-modal things, like, and just really pushed for that and advocated for that. So it was all into UX and UI design.
Okay.
That was super friendly for people to understand. And that also would make both developing for software, but mostly using computers easier by just letting people interact with stuff and not throwing up like modal dialogues and going into modal modes, right? So that was his big deal. And I think that's a very positive legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it looks like nomodes.com was actually his website. So yeah, very keen on non-modal software.
I see. Yeah, I see on Wikipedia, it mentions that, yes, he realized that users should be able to do everything at all times rather than having to be in a certain mode. And apparently the word processor that was mentioned, Gypsy, he heavily used that notion to structure it. Yeah. And I was just reading my wiki reader to get that additional information.
Perfect.
So, pull it out of my pocket. So,
in 2016,
put it back in. Yeah.
The following was true.
Yeah. Yes,
well, fortunately, he was still with us for one
thing.
That's true. That's true. So that's that, but good to mark his passing. And let's see, another, I guess I'll mention this. Nobody deleted it from the list, so I guess it's fair game. I'm guessing from the name of this device, it's been around for a few years. I was in a Twitter conversation with somebody about something I don't exactly recall, but someone mentioned using their RC 2014, and I had to go look it up. Apparently, they mentioned that they use it for WordStar, and I thought, okay, this sounds interesting. Have we talked about this, or have you talked about this on the show
earlier in this episode?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, like, I think.
Wait, why is this ringing such a recent bell? Somebody said RC 2014 earlier in this.
That
show.
That is true, because that is the source of our host topic.
Oh, okay. I've been going crazy. Yeah. I swear somebody just mentioned this. Okay.
Well.
But I think it hasn't been any time recently that we've talked about this. I feel like I'm sort of aware of this project, but no new developments of it.
Yeah. Well, I just, as someone who had not encountered it, it struck me not just the, well, what it is, it's a Z80 homebrew kit that you can assemble. And, it was a very basic kit designed, I think, to actually run BASIC, if I'm not mistaken. That was the, I've got my notes, to run the BASIC, Microsoft BASIC, and it was expanded. ROM was built out, and I think the spec of the board changed, and it became able to actually run full CPM operating system. And the thing that I guess it caught my eye was there are these little expansion cards. If you look at the not actually showing it on the screen, but it's the main board is basically a board of slots, and kind of like the old S100 machines, it looks like you plug the various pieces, the drive, the CPU, into them. And it seems a very kind of nifty little hands-on looking simple system. And it appealed to me the way it's modular, it's small, and it's almost cute, actually. So I had never heard of it, and it seemed appealing, and I thought I would bring that up. I'd like to learn more.
Yeah, it's definitely very cute. I really do kind of like the way it's all modular like that. So like you can you get the little pieces that you need, and it's basically all just connected together on some little motherboard.
Yeah, it seemed something really tickles me, I guess, the way it's arranged.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind. I'd like to have one and see it work. And I see you're showing the various expansions for it. Looks like it's still there's still pieces available.
Yeah.
And you can, I guess, depending on how much you want to manually solder versus, you know, pay up for assembled, there are options there.
And it looks like one of the pieces is a a way that you can attach a Raspberry Pi to it.
Right. Cool. Very cool.
It's shocking how many things you can attach a Raspberry Pi to these days.
Yeah.
Everything.
I keep getting them.
I have a couple that stuck in me at the moment.
I have to think of something good to do with them.
You don't even know how many you have.
Because, I mean, well, they keep getting slightly better. They're currently, they have wireless connectivity, so you don't actually have to connect them to something. And they're pretty, it's a little Linux machine. So.
Yep. Yeah, I've got one sitting on a card inside my TI-99 behind me. It links it to the internet and acts like a hard drive and acts like a floppy drive. And
yeah, Ivanex makes a similar thing for the Apple II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think we've talked about this before, but having something like that where you have a little brain and you can just sort of like connect that brain in various ways to speak for yourself. But having the ability to connect a Raspberry Pi to a bunch of different retro computers does really, the Pi itself is cheap, so if you can use the stuff that it comes with in a way that can give you, internet connectivity or a clock or a hard, hard drive or whatever, would be great.
Yeah. It's cheap enough now. I think the guy who set out to build the device I was referring to for the TI is called the Tippy. The TI Pi. I have the Tippy Peb, which is the version that slots into the peripheral expansion box. But he was setting out to do this, and he was looking at like a propeller or an Arduino or something, and something simple and I guess cheaper than the Pi. He wasn't thinking about the Pi, but his friend was like, "Well, just like it would be so much easier if you just took a Pi for $25 or however much they are." Right. Just write your code in Python and don't worry about, linking all the things you'd have to do with an Arduino or a propeller. And it's like, well, it seems like overkill, but he did it. And then, of course, he ended up with expanded capabilities that can do everything. And because you've got a multi-core modern computer sitting inside, this very slow old machine built like a tank. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Put them everywhere, I think.
We were talking about something just much like this with the MBX, the TI add-on, where you add on a much better computer to your TI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
I believe that's actually based on the 6809, which we were talking about earlier, is arguably the most powerful 8-bit processor. So yeah, it's that's a better computer than the TI. Yeah.
All right. Carrington, you have MIDI.
MIDI, yes. I know nothing about MIDI, and I've never been a fan because I could never, not being a musician, I can never keep straight in my head that there's a difference between MIDI, the protocol that people who are good at instrumenting things attach their instruments to computers and then can play the keyboard or it plays the keyboard automatically, like all that protocol stuff. But I thought of MIDI as, well, you would download these songs that you just play in your computer and they would sound terrible. I'm like, why does anybody like this? But regardless, so MIDI has recently gotten an update. It's 37 years later and MIDI 2.0 has just come out, which is crazy to me. I'm like, what? How's it on version 2? So 1983, MIDI 1 came out and it's taken this long for there to be MIDI 2. And as you can imagine, being such a long gap, there is a significant increase. So MIDI is going from 7 bits to 32 bits. I'm like, how has MIDI in 2019 still been a 7-bit protocol?
Yeah.
So it was.
Seriously.
And they say that was one of the significant reasons, I guess, that there was sometimes some latency issue, but more that MIDI was really good with working with keyboards, because a lot of it was like 7-bit, 128 steps in how you're pressing down a key is usually enough, because it can then say, okay, here's how the strings and such would react in a piano. But it's different if you're trying to use a MIDI guitar or a MIDI bass or something like that, where you really want to capture a lot of nuance in, in timing and that sort of thing. It's also gone to a full duplex thing. It is now a two-way protocol, and it was originally a one-way protocol. But because of the way they've done it, it's completely backwards compatible. And I guess a ton of features have been added to the protocol because nobody's really sure what will be necessary over the next 30 years, and which just seems to be how often this upgrades. So who knows how this will affect computers and computer-based music recording and production going forward, but it seems to be a fairly significant leap, but is also completely backwards compatible. So people that are really into MIDI, I guess, are very excited about this. I know nothing about it. I was just really tickled by the fact that it was an 8-bit protocol still. I find that hilarious. And I'm like, come on, really? Yep. And it's finally become bidirectional and will be a full 32 bits versus 7. So fairly, and then a whole bunch of protocol differences and whatever, all of which is backward compatible. So music people are excited. I'm just kind of laughing about it. But well done, MIDI people. That's what I do. I think you know anything more about MIDI than I do, which would be like anything.
I get you on the .mid files. That sounds horrible on a PC, on a Windows. I was an Atari ST guy for a while, and of course it had the MIDI ports and had in and out.
Being an Apple guy, I've always thought like one beep, that's enough. Like nobody needs more sound than that. Like,
nobody needs more than that. But it, and I guess it became sort of popular in some of the, you know, late 80s music scenes. And of course, I guess having an ST here, and I do have a MIDI keyboard. I have a music keyboard that I didn't know had MIDI, and it occurred to me, oh, look, let me look, it does. And I hooked it up, and I play the song from Music Studio out through the MIDI keyboard on the Atari, and that was the one time I ever used MIDI. So it sounded better than the Atari, but not that much better for a $50 Radio Shack keyboard. I don't have much else beyond. You've heard that's my expertise limit there.
Yeah,
I have MIDI cables from my Atari ST sitting under the ST. I wonder if they're gonna. Well, I guess now tech. It seems like the hardware that I encounter now, if I'm strolling through, you know, one of the Guitar Center or whatever, it'll be the MIDI protocol, but they'll send it over like USB or something. Right. You know, it's not.
That makes sense.
They're not really using these large. What is it, DIN 5s?
I was about to say that we're going to have a link. Well, we will have a link to an article about this on QZ.com. And I was going to say that because of the article, I actually learned what MIDI stands for. It was always capitalized, so I knew it stood for something. But it's Musical Instrument Digital Interface. But I don't know if I can really say I learned that, because I bet if you quiz me next show, I won't know what that stands for. I don't feel like any of this is really sticking in me at all.
Well, I knew what it stood for because when I had the Atari ST, you had to be at war with the Amiga people. And so I had to have the full feature set fully described for the online battles. So you definitely have to be like, well, where's your MIDI port? Where's your musical instrument digital interface port? And then they talked to me about copper bars, and it was always kind of.
And that's Apple II people show up at the party. Want to hear my beep? Oh, how everyone would ask.
All right. Let's see. I have two sort of notes in the news section. One of them is a little bit more major than the other. I'll talk about the minor one first, I guess. This was just pointed out, so this is actually a feedback even by.
Is it from Blake?
No, it's by Niels on Twitter.
Okay, good.
And it is the BBC Microbot. I had not come across this before. I think it's pretty cool. What it is it's a Twitter account. If you tweet at it some basic code, it will run it on a BBC Micro and give you the output. So,
and what format is the output in?
It's in an animated.
How do you pronounce that?
Animated.
Say it.
But so, for example, you know, we have this.
I'm trying to control myself.
Blake and I can team up on you.
We know how it's pronounced.
Exactly.
It's pretty cool, though.
But this is a pretty amazing thing that you can just tweet some basic code to a Twitter account and get back a graphic of it running. Yeah. That's pretty amazing.
Is there a filter, though? Like, how long before someone starts, you know, bathroom walling a graphic? You know what
Well,
I mean?
It's possible. I'm not sure what I'm reading, but I think it's their self-description. But it says, bad words equals auto block.
But so if I have ever been motivated to enter the 10-line basic contest, it's now.
That's a good point.
Because, like, just enter through this.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so I think it's going
to... Yeah, I'm going to have to play with this.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And it's I mean, it would be, I think, pretty easy to do other things, too. But yeah, the exactly like a 2-line basic program for any platform might be kind of fun to do. I wonder how quickly... Like, I would imagine that you wouldn't really get overwhelmed unless it's by, you know, rogue bots that aren't actually playing the game right.
Well, the funny thing is, if you scroll through the Twitter feed for the Microbot, it basically, there's three categories of things. There's the 10 print this, 20 go to 10 in lots of different colors over and over and over again. So there's a ton of that. There's a ton of people drawing the kind of the exact same line graphic that it must be really, really popular with people. And then a whole bunch of mistake at line 10, mistake, like it's just a printout that shows the syntax error. I'm like, dude, really? That is shockingly embarrassing for you. Like, you couldn't test this code before you sent it to the bot. Oh my gosh. So there's a lot of that. And it just posts it. It just like shames you online. Like, here, your code doesn't work. You couldn't get six lines of BASIC to work.
I think the real challenge would be to write a BASIC program that escapes the virtual machine and traverses the data center and gains, you know, control of whatever the VM, the virtual machine arbitrator is. Yeah. And then you have your own data center.
Well, I think all you have to do is count up to 65537, right?
Right.
or enter a full modern date, I guess. Yeah. See what happens.
Yeah, but it's pretty sweet, though. This is a great use for a bot. Yeah.
Definitely.
All right. Let's see.
I like it.
Carrington Wood, you have another thing here.
I do?
You do.
Oh, tiny emulators. Yeah, so right along the same lines. If you want to play a thing, you want to play a retro 8-bit computer game, but you really don't feel like doing anything. You just want to just play right now. You're standing in line. You got your phone or whatever. There's a neat thing called Tiny Emus online that is strictly like one-trick ponies. You go to the website. It's a ton of little squares that show you the opening screen of a game and a lot of stuff. The CPC, it's very Eurocentric, so it's a lot of CPC stuff, a lot of ZX80 things, sort of some C64 things, but it's mostly like if you want to play some Spectrum games or whatever. And that's the whole point, is you can just like hover over something. So here's Labyrinth for the KC85. You click on it, opens a window, it's playing. Like, that's it. It's just really fast, really simple. You install nothing. It's just like a quick fix to play a retro game. Mm-hmm. And because it's not oriented towards the kind of computers that I had access to and I was interested in, I find it particularly interesting because there's a ton of games here and I had no idea what they were. And I found this a couple hours ago and a game's been added in the meantime. So it's in that time, there's a new game. So it seems to be something that's growing. I was playing a game called Rick Dangerous for the CPC. Not necessarily a great game, but I had never heard of it before. I played like a half an hour of this game. And it's awesome. And it's just a great way to get a quick fix of a retro game. I really dig it. So
that's great. Some of them are pretty obscure, like the Robotron KC87. I've seen that online, but Lord, that was not a common thing, even in Europe, I don't think, was it?
So it's great, and like super fun, and maybe most of the games won't be great or whatever, but whatever, just like there's going to be something here that will interest you if you're a listener to the show, and so you just like go to the link, you're just standing, like it works terrifically well, and it's click, bing, you're playing in 2 seconds.
I see from the screen, you can, it'll set you up ready to write a program in Forth or BASIC or some of the other languages. And it looks like they've also got, which is my cup of tea, they've got just some canned demo scene production. So I'm a very big scene demo fan. Lower down on the page, the color one, colorful thing. So that's very cool. You see some effects. I think they're just demos.
And I know you can do a similar thing with the Internet Archive, of course. There's lots of online games and things you can play. Like that's the dream of all of this, is these one-click playing things. So then if you're talking about a game, say you're doing a write-up, say you're a guy like Blake, and you write things, and you get people on your own. It's neat to be able to just have a link when you describe a game, and click on it, and it pops up a window, and now you're playing the game. Like, you're just, like, instantly playing that game.
It doesn't require a plug-in or anything? It just runs?
Nope. Everything's just running off. It probably requires a relatively modern browser. I'm assuming it's running HTML5 or something like that. I installed nothing. I tried it on both Safari and Chrome. Both of them work great. I just clicked, and it played.
Wow. Yeah, probably heavy JavaScript. I mean, it's a driver or WebSM, as they call it, which I'm not heavily familiar with, but sounds scary.
Yeah. So anyway, I dig it. It's really nice, called Tiny Emus. Well worth the bookmark.
I will check it out.
I like it. Yeah. I mean, it really does seem like you said this, but I mean, it seems like it is. It's maybe even one step easier than those emulations in the Internet Archive. I mean, like, it's just, you know, you got a screenshot, you click the thing.
you go. And you're playing.
Yeah,
that's it.
I agree.
But Dangerous, I recommend the game. It's fun. I'm stuck. I can't get very far in it. It's a little platformer, and I dig it.
Yeah, and some of these, you actually have to do something like Robotron KCI-87. You have to type basic enter to make it go.
Oh, but, that's too much work.
Very nice.
I'm out.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. And then so my last thing is, because this is half of the show is about Kansas Fest anyway, we have Kansas Fest has announced the keynote. And
it's a good
so
one.
The keynote is Robert Woodhead. So and Kansas Fest itself is July 21st to 26th. The registration is not available yet, but I think it won't be too long. I'm not actually sure when registration starts. But yeah, so Robert Woodhead, if you do not know, is the person who he co-wrote basically Wizardry, which was a huge role-playing game for the Apple II, went from there to being on a number of other platforms as well.
Right.
But I did not play this very much, but I know it was a big part of a lot of people's childhood. Did either of you play Wizardry or even any other Surtek games?
I had it. You know, I had a copy of it, but I didn't really play it. Mm-hmm. So I remember the intro screen, but no, I had a neighbor who was very much into it. But mm-hmm. it was certain, and I actually have a boxed copy on the shelf for some reason for a Commodore, which is even more.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow.
Yeah,
that's obscure.
I think. Wait, maybe I'm wrong. Or is it Atari? Maybe I'm wrong about what it's for. But anyway, I feel like it wasn't for the Apple because I couldn't load it with what I had. But anyway, I haven't actually played it much. How about you, Paul?
I suspect that a lot of people have the same kind of view of it I do, which is I think of it as sort of like I have very positive, happy feelings toward it. And like I like it as a game, but I did not play it.
Have you never played it?
So, I mean, I see the intro screen.
Kind of there.
Yeah. It's
like, it's seriously a dungeon crawler. Yeah. Like when you compare it against things like Ultima or whatever, which are like full adventure RPGs, Wizardry is here. You and your small party are going in and fight monsters every square, fight, 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 fight. It's literally a dungeon crawler.
And it had this kind of 3D perspective wireframe thing that you were walking in, you know?
Mm, yeah. Which is the thing that really set it aside or set it apart when it came out was that 3D wireframe view of the like looking down the hallways of the dungeon and like the monster that pops up that you're about to tackle or the chest or the trap or the whatever. That's the thing versus like a text adventure at the time.
I know that, you know, despite not having really played it seriously, like I would get into a fight and then that would be it and then I'd quit, you know, but I mean, in game, I would get in this fight, but there was something that's very, I don't know, it was inspiring seeing that wireframe, you know, the being able to look down the hallway and see where you're going to go next and stuff.
I never played it much when I was younger. I played it as part of like a review thing on 1 MHz thing, but that was much more recently, right? So, but as a kid, I probably dabbled with Wizardry. I didn't own an actual copy. I would have been playing off a hacked copy or something, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't even have any memories of playing it as a kid, to be honest. It was everywhere, though. It was everywhere for forever. Like, for years and years and years and years. And like, you'd read magazines and it'd be like, oh, it's 2016. Here's our Wizardry character editor. Like, it seemed to never go away.
Yeah, the some other things about it. It's actually surprisingly well protected.
Maybe that's why I never really had it as a kid or why I didn't play it.
I mean, I think, you know, there were cracked copies out there, but actually successfully copying the disc is really difficult. And I think of that as like one of the test case ones, actually. And they did this clever thing, you know, in retrospect, it seems like kind of a low tech solution, but, as part of their copy protection, they checked to see if they could write to the disc. And if they could write to the disc, then it counted as a copy because of course the original disc was write protected. So you couldn't do that.
I was trying to find my boxed copy. I failed. I found Turbo 64 though, but I couldn't find Wizardry. Oh well.
Oh well.
So anyway, yeah, the I think that's going to be pretty cool to hear Robert Wood talk about this.
Yes. So,
looking forward to that. And
so if you want to get your Wizardry signed,
oh yeah,
Kansas Fest is going to be a good place to do it.
I have yet to go to Kansas Fest. I should...
This is the best time. Could be the last one. You never know.
It's super fun.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The committee's kind of going downhill recently since Paul got on it.
That's what I hear. That's what I hear.
That's the rumor I spread anyway.
Anyway, yeah. So that's pretty exciting news. There will soon be wizardry related art, presumably, and stuff like that. Boy, this is we're recording for a long time. We have no
I blame
self-control here. anyway, that was the end of the items of interest and news. It is now, I think we've ticked over an hour and a half already. But now a word from our sponsor.
The Atari XE. Two systems in one for twice the fun.
With the Atari XE game system, I can experience all the excitement and challenge of the arcades and the real-life action of sports. Or I can use the Atari XE as a computer to help me with my homework. Two systems in one for twice the fun. The Atari XE.
And now Atari will give you a $50 rebate on your XE system, making your cost under $100. System includes console, keyboard, joystick, light gun, and three software programs.
Great games. Helpful computer applications. See your Atari dealer for details today.
And we're back. During the commercial you just heard, whatever that was, we have come to the conclusion that the host's retro computing gift idea is a computer lib unisex t-shirt for only $22 from Gamiani.com. Gamiani.com.
Which is on sale, regular price of $25, mm-hmm. and computer lib, a book. Most people who listen to this probably already know what that book is. And we talked about a few episodes ago, there was one relatively inexpensive for this book on eBay or something like that, because it goes for a ton of money. Like, oh my gosh, just get the PDF, which is much more in keeping with the thoughts of the book anyway. but I've always liked the computer lib, that, raised fist icon. I dig it. And so I like this t-shirt. This is a shirt I would probably wear.
Mm-hmm. And it's not too expensive.
No, $22. Comes in a bunch of colors as well. But I mean, if you're going to be in keeping with the regular book, it would just be, black on white.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
That whole sort of like terminology, which I think, I mean, essentially I believe this to be kind of taken from the phrase women's lib, right? But that feels super dated now. Mm-hmm. Like I'm kind of wondering, like when I'm looking at this and thinking like, all right, what are the people who don't know anything about the 1980s see when they see this?
Or 1970s, really, in this case, I think. But it's a thing of its time, like liberation, the whole idea of, like a repressed thing being liberated, women's lib and just lib for many things. And in this case, computers. Yeah. So I think it's, if you're of that, like, I guess this is probably 1974, 1975, something like that. I think it's perfect. It's the raised fist. I dig it. I still dig it. I boycott almost everything all the time anyway. So it's very much up my alley.
Cool.
Computers for everybody. And I think that's also nicely in keeping with the unfortunate passing of Larry Tesler. He was really into modeless things and computers should be easier. Right. So this seems to work well. I like it. I like it thematically.
Okay.
Yep.
Excellent. So once you're done submitting your order for that, you can turn to eBay. Blake has come with numbers rivaling
Blake has
mine.
Come to play.
I wanted to add you, Paul, so I have 75 eBay items.
I'm going to go get a drink.
That I've. So just sit back.
Yeah, but anyway, so if you wanted to start talking through the ones you have here.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you got?
So I've got, it looks like I got four. And they're, nothing earth shattering, but I thought.
Oh, come on, this first one's unreal.
Well, it's a little much. Okay, so the first one. It is a keyboard. It's an ADB keyboard, but calling it an ADB keyboard really is not getting right into the crux of what this situation is. It's an ADB keyboard. It looks like someone who perhaps makes keyboards.
It's a parody of a keyboard.
Had some sort of a severe psychotic break and began just going akimbo with the key placements. It looks like within this monstrosity, there is a keyboard that we would all recognize as a standard keyboard and even a cursor array and a number pad. But then There's another number pad.
And then that's what I love. There's a second number
pad. There's actually a third. Really, there's three number pads. And there's some blank spots. It looks like they got tired. Like in the middle, there's four
literally
keys.
They ran out of ideas. There's so many. Right. This is like a 300-key keyboard. And it's, the best part is the main part of the keyboard, like your QWERTY yeah. bit, all the letters. That's on the top half of it. Like that's so it's like they you have 3,500 function keys, all of which are below the regular part of the keyboard.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. I love this thing.
I'm assuming it's probably some sort of a CAD keyboard. I did not go into deep research on this one.
This is not for writing a novel. Yes, this is definitely the letters are the least important thing you're doing.
It's a crazy looking thing. I found a data sheet on it, and all that I could find was it's called an operator keyboard. Mm-hmm. So maybe these are people that are responsible for large moving systems. The person that could diverts a train collision on a badly routed track, maybe he's got this keyboard to jump into action and save it.
The only bad part is it's the case is slightly cracked down on the bottom, so that's disappointing. Probably fixable, but disappointing.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to buy it and just take it into the office and just sit down and I don't say anything. Yeah. Just put it in front of my desk and say, okay, all right, let's gather around.
I'm ready to operate.
Yeah, I'm going to, you know, we've gone plaid. So, but anyway, so there you go. So it's, I don't know how much time I probably should have taken a closer look. Is it still available? Yeah. Yes. It's a buy it now. So, okay.
It's in New Zealand.
All right. And New Zealand. So the shipping would be, it looks like 60, well, whoever that is. Is that
it
Paul?
Is, yeah. $60. Yeah.
For you. But at any rate, so there it is. I'll move on. This is interesting. It's the next item is a terminal called the rare. It's a rare terminal, which I'll give you as rare. Telerai, which is the thing that got my attention. And I always pay attention to terminals because I like, as we talked about earlier, BBSing, you know, and you can definitely always use a dumb terminal to do that. But yeah, so it's a Model 10T. But the thing is, it looks like it's a little bit lower. The casing looks slightly lower quality than the prop furniture that you'll see at like a furniture warehouse or, you know, like a Hanes or whatever. Yeah, it looks like.
It is really bad.
Absolutely, the cheapest possible. I think the case may be one piece of molded plastic, two
you
at the
just
most.
You know it's thin as heck plastic. Just
yeah,
looking
well, you
at
can
it,
almost
I,
feel like
can
you, if you were to tap it, you could the whole thing would you just know it would vibrate for a few moments. But and it also looks like it has a Symbolics keyboard, which is odd. Mm-hmm. It has that distinctive blue.
Oh,
and,
great.
And white and yellow, and I don't think they used to have that variation of white and yellow. I think that it was all white.
The yellow bits are just H.
Yeah, anyway, it was such a bizarre looking thing, and it seems to function. It has, or at least it has something on the screen.
And it isn't garbage. It looks like it was typed. Yeah, it's the alphabet.
Just somebody typed the alphabet.
I mean,
all the keys working.
It's pretty dirty. It's pretty dirty, and it's got a little pin holder up above the keyboard, I guess, and a place for peanuts above the number pad.
Or maybe this is where you rest
it's
your
pen
cigarette.
What if the pin holder of this mold? Maybe this mold was also used for a terminal or something that had a pen, like a digital pen.
Oh, I thought you were suggesting it had a line of mold across the top, which wouldn't be surprising. But yes, it could be that maybe it had the old school grid optical touchscreen. Yeah. Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so, like the HPs. Okay, so there was that. Moving on. This one just struck me as odd because it's billed as the Brady Writer 2 industrial printing system. And as far as I can tell, what it is a suitcase, maybe with a power supply built in, that's housing the items. They have a Brady brand name sticker above and below, you know, or on both the but what it is, I guess I should explain. You open up this suitcase and you're presented with a printer front and center, and then underneath the printer, it can slide out as a small word processor type device, a Model 100 looking laptop. But the shape and design of both the printer and the laptop kind of just rang a bell in my mind. And as far as I can tell, I knew, I said, that looks like an NEC laptop. And so I looked back and yeah, I think it's an NEC PC8201, or I think there was a PC8800 also that was very similar. So it appears to be exactly that, which is a Model 100 type device. That, you know, it's 7 lines or something like that, 60 characters, something like that, with little word processor built in. And the printer is just a relabeled Okidata Microline 182. So I guess the value add is that is the printer, it looks, I guess the printer is bolted to a metal sheet that is attached to the, the midsection. So basically you're not going to drop this thing, but so basically
do, it'll be the last thing you do.
Yeah,
well, that's what I'm thinking. This must be so heavy.
Right, right. So it's the Brady system, I guess, whoever, you know, the Brady organization, they took these, yeah, they took these two items and created a thing. And
but it's hilarious because the bottom, selling. You're right, is this like metal kind of case all bolted together. And then the cables for the printer run down inside that. It's like, dear Lord, hope nothing gets unplugged down below.
Yeah, it seems very, you know, I it seems like the sort of thing you'd see in the back of a magazine where you just buy the case. You're like, okay, I want to turn my gear into a mobile workstation. But yeah.
I wonder what the market for this could have been, though, because by the time this was out, there must have been portable typewriters that had memory function. That is all this is really offering. It's but in a 60-pound package. It's crazy.
I mean, it's and it seems like if you were wanting to do portable word processing, now of course the difference is the printing. But I mean, if you grab that NEC laptop, that's pretty portable. Mm-hmm. You could take that somewhere. But I guess the niche here is not only do I want to word process on the go, so to speak, but I need to print it. And yeah, I guess that's
loudly and slowly.
Yeah, exactly.
With after, like, you want to alternate which arm you're carrying it in, so you end up with that nice workout on both sides.
Excellent for hipsters to take to Starbucks today.
Oh yeah, that would really be the main appeal, I think, to buying that. But I'm not going to do that. All right, so I just thought that was interesting.
Paul will buy it.
I recognized it.
It's so yellow. It's so
it's so yellow.
Do you think I wondered if it was started out yellow, or it surely wasn't white.
It looks like the kind of yellow that didn't start out quite that yellow.
Yeah, but maybe it
looks like a tan or a beige that's become that.
All right, and the next item, my last item is, and again, this is my BBS, fetish has me, had me looking at this, and this is just a nifty little unit. It's a TI Model 707, and what it is a screenless terminal, as many terminals, perhaps all terminals were at one point. It's small. It's about the size of the aforementioned NEC 8201, I believe, and it has a full size keyboard, but it's not much bigger than that. And serial port, you do what you like as far as connecting to a host, and instead of showing you what you're typing and what you're receiving on a screen, it's printing it on paper with a built-in printer. Actually, this thing looks like it would make a far better Brady mobile typing system, Brady writer too, if they just grab this thing alone. And
totally.
And
this appeals to me. I love a terminal that's like a print everything as you go terminal. Mm-hmm. Like, that is totally the way somebody should work with a terminal. Love it.
Yeah, usually they're huge, and this one, actually the design, it hasn't, even aside from the fact that it's sleek, I mean, within its form factor, I like the color of the translucence on the plastic. It's a nice designed unit. I would actually enjoy, you know, putting my Wi-Fi 232 on this, you know, just logging in and having, you know, a session on the BBS, even though it's, you know, rather impractical, obviously. But it's nifty that this and other items, I'm sure, like this existed.
I love it. I think that is a fantastic choice.
I would not mind having it.
Yeah.
It's $150.
This actually appeals to me.
$150 from North Carolina in the U.S., and for me, shipping would be $11.10. So $12.04 up to Boston.
Interesting.
So,
it's interesting that it makes a difference. But
Yeah, it's a clean little unit. I like it.
I wonder if there would be...
But that's all I got.
So, I mean, one of the things about any of these printers is that they require paper, right, and ink. I wonder if there would be any kind of a So, A, I wonder if the technology could be, you know, exists or could be made to exist to have something that would be, that would sort of serve as like temporary paper that you could, your impact printer could impact upon it and you would be able to see the places where the impact was, but then eventually it would fade away like an Etch-a-Sketch. Reusable paper, right?
Well, it could be a loop of paper, right?
Yeah.
Would that work physically? Yes, if it would somehow fade, like one of those creepy cloth hand washing things in some bathrooms, the loop of cloth.
Oh, right.
If you remember those?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they always, it's like, how many times has this been like,
exactly. Like, am I the first time through this or not?
Yeah.
I'll just use my pants.
Yeah. But no, it seems like that if you could have a loop, an impact thing that, right, you wouldn't use ink. Mm-hmm. You'd want it to be, you know, you'd want it to feel the impact. So you'd basically not, you'd put an empty cartridge in. And it would have to be something that,
It seems like that might be one way maintain the experience of having printed something without having to figure out where to put the thing or where to buy the new paper or the, you know, re-inked ribbons or whatever.
Hmm.
Well, it seems like the appeal for such a thing would be so huge for these people that want to have the impact, that want to have the CRT-less terminal experience, that I'm shocked that this hasn't already come to market. So I'm sure any day it'll drop.
Definitely. It is true that you know, whatever advantage there is to not having a CRT is starting to fade if you have, you know, whatever temporary reusable paper.
that's when I think you really do go get that therapist session penciled in.
Okay.
That's all I have.
Carrington, you have a couple.
Oh, I got a great one. I don't know if you guys are aware of the Pepper's Ghost trick. Do you know that illusion?
I do not.
Well, you're about to learn it. So my first choice is something called a paint mate. And this is shockingly hilarious. Never heard of one of these things before. I love this device. So it is for a classic original Mac format form factor. So you got basically SE30 and earlier. It shows a Mac Plus in it. And all it really is a slightly opaque piece of plastic that hooks onto the front of your computer on an angle, and that's it. And it's a drawing. It uses the Pepper's Ghost illusion to act as a drawing tool. So the idea with Pepper's Ghost is you have a plane of glass, clear or slightly shadowed, and if you have a very bright object oblique from that, when you look through the glass, part of it you're going to see the reflection of the thing to the side. So it's like a thing you use in theater to make it like a ghost appear. And it's because you're looking through the glass and you're seeing a reflection where part of the item is actually off to the side and you're looking at that in reflection, but you have a bright screen or bright stage behind it. Same thing here. So the idea is you would hang this on the front of your computer and then in this case, stick like an apple at the base of your computer. Then when you're looking through your screen, you're going to kind of see the floating apple reflected in there and then you can draw it as if you're tracing it, but you're just using the reflection. This is amazing. I can't believe this product existed.
That's very clever. I've never seen that, although it's driving me insane that on the cover that apple is not centered.
To show you the idea in the actual picture of this, they stuck the apple between the screen and the glass, just sticking there. But it's supposed to be the apple would be at the base of your computer, and when you look through to the bright screen, since the light's coming out, part of it's going to reflect down. You're going to see that reflection. How well this would work, I don't know. It's amazing that this thing existed. I can't believe somebody actually made this. So if you've got a 3D object, you wanted to basically draw or trace out on your old Mac using Mac Paint, this is how you could get an image of it kind of floating in front of the screen. I love this thing. I love that this existed.
The user guide image that you just scrolled over, Paul, I think gives the kind of a better that actually shows how. Yeah.
And so that's the idea is you stick the object to the bottom.
Interesting.
Look through the glass that's tilted at like a 30-degree angle, and you'll see the and essentially this same idea. If you have four of these pieces of angled glass, like imagine it is how you can make a hologram if you've got a computer or whatever. Like that's what you do is you put four of them, make a square, and project an item between them, or project an item around all four sides, and if you look through the glass, you'll see a hologram floating. Like this is essentially leads to holograms. I love it. So it's called the Mac Paint Mate. I'd never even heard of it before. This is probably the only one that ever sold.
Yeah.
And you can buy it. Super rare indeed. $125. I don't want it, but I'm tickled that it exists.
And to watch
this. That's impressive.
Yep. That was my first choice. But second choice, in case you want to know, can you afford to buy a Mac PaintMate? Well, you can use my second choice, which is an Apple Credit Plan Calculator. All of this is a calculator, but it's branded for the Apple Credit Plan. I don't know what that was. Presumably, there was a time when you'd go in and you'd get a credit to buy your computer, like through Apple, so you'd have payments. And so, and I guess if you did that, here was a free solar calculator. So it's one of those really teeny tiny thin calculators with the flat buttons, very awkward to use, but it's solar based, has an Apple logo on it.
I like I like they use that credit card font, you know, the beveled font that is pressed out. That's
totally sort of, all the buttons look like they're on a credit card. You're right. Yes, it's all credit card font. So anyway, problem with this one is $200. So you buy yourself this $200. It would be for me by now because I think it's located in Toronto. So I can go pick it up. $200 Canadian, which is about $150 US, I guess. I am not selling this, in case you're wondering. This is not for me.
Yeah, I don't need a calculator to figure out that I'm not going to buy
that. I can't afford
this
calculator.
Yeah, that I can't.
So but it caught my eye because I wasn't really sure what the Apple credit plan was, and it's a little Apple calculator and a little solar thing. So presumably still works, but it's not shown to be working. Maybe it didn't charge up enough. Anyway, those are my two choices. First one just tickles that kind of me, though.
Yeah.
That's pretty great.
What about you, Paul? What are you bringing to the table?
Well, let's see. I have
Marathon. I love Marathon.
A whole bunch of sort of random things, but I'll go through them for a little bit, I suppose. So I put this in. There's nothing in particular that I had to say about this auction specifically. It's an auction for Marathon Infinity. It's for a still sealed one. So it's being – the asking price is $230. It's still wrapped. Marathon – and I assume, you know, we've talked about it enough that people have heard about it, but it's basically like a first-person shooter game. It was one of the earliest ones, not the earliest.
Yeah, from Bungie, and I love the whole series. Loved it so much.
Yeah, so Bungie, it came after – they had a previous one called Pathways into Darkness, which was a little bit like that.
That's not as good.
But this one is sort of set on a spaceship, and there were – I think there were three. So Marathon. Yeah.
Marathon 1, Marathon 2, and then Marathon Infinity.
And – so actually the main reason I linked to this auction was just, first of all, it's interesting that it still exists, but the box is cool. Like they had this.
Yeah, all three of them came in this incredibly neat triangular box. It's awesome.
And it's actually pretty hard because you can't, you know, like most of the time people open them up and the box got beat up or lost or whatever. So you don't actually see the box very often. So you have to find these still wrapped ones to see them in their original shape. But there and the pictures in this auction are actually pretty terrible. But any rate, I think I did like the box. I had all three of the boxes, I think. And you know, like I was just saying, they get lost or smashed or whatever.
Yeah. So I had all three back in the day because I bought the software and played the heck out of them. This is one of the friends and I would get together every couple of weeks and do LAN parties, you know, the old fashioned, like lug your computer to one dude's house kind of LAN party. Nice. And we frequently would play Marathon.
Nice.
Yeah. Anyway, I thought it was kind of neat. I'm not suggesting anyone buy them. You might keep an eye out for them if you see them. And, you know, cause it's an old Mac game. So if it weren't.
Yeah, like a 040.
Yeah. So if it were not wrapped or if you were dealing with somebody who doesn't really know anything about the market, it would probably be, you know, 25 cents. So it's like normal people would pay that much for it.
There are box people.
Yeah.
Sure.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No,
you can, we should mention that if you like Marathon and you should, cause it's great. Aleph One is the Mac OS 10 and Windows version. You can play on a modern computer.
Yeah. I keep installing it and then keep not quite getting around to playing it, but you can still play it. If you, well, if you miss those days.
I do.
And probably, you know, it's probably faster now on the, you know, the multi-core whatever computer you're running. Okay, so this one, I think I just keep linking to this one because I think it's ridiculous. It's the, from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it's the, there's a little, one of the things that came in the Infocom Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was this plastic bag that said Microscopic Space Fleet on it. And this is being sold, but bag only. So it doesn't actually have the space fleet in it.
Actually, it does have the space fleet. They don't realize.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's as much there as it ever was.
It's still sealed. That is exactly how it comes.
Yeah.
That's one of the few. I don't have a lot of Infocom boxed software. I've been playing through this stuff with Kevin for the Eaten by a Group mm-hmm. podcast. And one of the ones I have actually is the Hitchhiker's one. It has great feelings.
Yeah. Yeah, it has one of the things that's in it is a button that says don't panic. And I think those are actually a little bit hard to find because people used them. They wore their don't panic buttons out and then lost them.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, and it's got a peril sensitive sunglasses, which are really just kind of cardboard, but you put them on and they're just black. It's great. Great. I really like the game and I love the packaging for that one.
Yeah, I'd love to have the pack-ins for that. I definitely don't.
Okay.
You see my vast collection behind me. It's unsurprising that I have it.
Mm-hmm. Is that a space fleet? There's two space fleets behind you, aren't there?
a minimum of two at all times.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know why I linked to this, but I can tell you what I was thinking. It's kind of like a nothing auction in a way. It's an Apple II manual for an extended 80 column card.
I'm going to say, why did you look at it?
So the Apple IIe, I think originally it had, the 80 column and memory expansion was on a card. Or maybe it was actually just the 80 column that was on a card and the memory expansion came separately. But
there was an 80 column card which had 1K of RAM on it, and that allowed it to do 80 columns. And it was set in the aux slot on the 2E. Then there was the extended 80 column card. It had 65K of RAM on
it.
So it gave you 64, or maybe 64K, and it was used in a different way. But the extended gave you 64K more. The original was just 1K is all it took. The video hardware was able to do 80 columns. It just needed more memory.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And actually, so 64K is the kind of like, actually the memory map for the 128K Apple IIe is ridiculous. But
yes.
At any rate, it's like the 2E is a 64K machine. If you put one of these things, the extended 80 column card in, it was then that doubled the memory basically. And that became sort of the standard. Beagle Bros, had a pretty cool utility that would essentially let you run two Apple IIe's at once. You know, you would have one Apple IIe sitting in this extended 80 column, 64K, and then the other one would sit in your regular memory, and you could sort of swap back and forth between them. I don't remember exactly how this was. What was it called? Double take,
like
maybe?
Tool.
Or maybe that was the printer one. But anyway, very cool.
I wasn't aware of that.
Hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
It's kind of a neat idea. Anyway, so the Apple IIe came in, there was a first revision of it that I think, there was something that was different about it, revision A and revision B. So let's see if it actually says here. It mattered.
Double high res?
Yeah, here. Okay, so here it is. So extended 80 column card jumper block instructions. This is a very small picture, so it's not actually that easy to see. But there's a little spot for a jumper on the extended 80 column card that you had to put a jumper on, depending on, I think, whether you had a revision A or revision B board. And so that was why I linked to this, because this still has the jumper.
Oh, cool.
So that's
nifty.
With very yellow tape.
Official Apple jumper. Yeah.
But it's also sort of interesting that it looks like a manual, but it is actually hardware, basically. And actually, it's also just probably a jumper you could get anywhere. But I remember thinking it was sort of interesting that this manual actually came with a meaningful piece.
Mm-hmm.
So, very long story for that. But that's why I linked to it. Somebody linked me to this. I think it was Ian actually pointed this out. So this is a rare vintage 80s Microlink Industries Limited Aero 2000 computer.
I do not know the Aero 2000.
And I didn't either. It's basically, it's like, if you look at it, so it looks like, it says,
looks like an Apple II clone.
Exactly. And if you start it up, it acts like an Apple II clone. It says Aero on the top.
Didn't it say Z80 at the time?
Well, that's the thing. That's the weird thing. So here's a picture of the inside. It has a very Apple II looking board. It's laid out slightly differently.
Even the name is Aero, Apple, same number of letters. We'll start with A.
So and you look in the middle of the board, there's a kind of long chip that seems like where the processor would go. And if you zoom.
Yeah, this picture is
there. It is. It is a Z80. And I'm thinking, what is happening? this doesn't make any sense to me. Because, the listing does say it is a Z80 computer. And you see it booted up, and it's acting like an Apple II.
Apple emulation card. Got to be.
Well, yeah, so actually that's it. I guess that's hard to, it's a little hard to see, but so in the listing, there's a bunch of cards that are there, and one of them is a card that has 6502 on it. So essentially, this is a machine that is at its sort of like brain is a Z80 computer, but you can put a coprocessor 6502 on, which is basically the Apple II part.
That's crazy.
Oh, yeah. That's yeah.
How much did this thing cost?
I don't know. Well, I mean, so I wonder if it is actually sort of like, it's kind of inverted the relationship between the soft card, the Microsoft Z80 soft card, and the 6502, you know, like, and I wonder if anybody actually used it for, like, I wonder what happens if you start it without the 6502 right. card in it. Because I think it is an Apple II clone, basically. I mean, like, that was the intention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's weird, man.
That's, and that was so strange. Can you go back to the picture of the cards? Mm-hmm. There was, for those watching on YouTube, there's a, that's a weird thing at the bottom right. The firmware ID card. It looks like someone laid that out by hand. Uh-huh. It's just one chip on it. I don't know.
Well, actually, in the next picture as well is really weird because it's presumably the graphics card, but it's got two cables soldered on it that come off it. One is a typical composite male plug for your video out, but the other one is video in? It's a composite female.
It passes through because if it'll take the regular video, at least there were some Apple II 80COM cards like this, and it would just switch control from the motherboard to this thing when you went to 80COM mode. So you wanted it to pass through when this didn't have control. Yeah, Apple's 80COM card was more integrated with the system, but this is more like an Apple II Plus card. I'm guessing that this is this is certainly not a 2E compatible. It's a 2 Plus compatible. Yeah.
But it's very Apple II, like even the disk interface card on the picture of the four cards looks like an Apple II disk card.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, I believe that this is essentially, it was marketed as an Apple II, it is an Apple II, but, and maybe this is a way to actually get around, you know, legal issues, but it doesn't have the ROMs and it doesn't have the processor. It's a Z80 computer, but if you put in this card, the 6502 card, then it has all the stuff that you need to be an Apple II. So it's only the card that sort of could infringe on this copyright.
Which they probably sold through a third party or whatever. That's not us.
I think.
How weird.
Also, I think the weird looking card, the firmware ID card is probably, that's probably basically like a dongle. Like it's probably a software lock for some software.
Mm. Maybe so.
Anyway. Yeah,
strange.
This, I had never heard of this computer, but I really like the way it's set up. I would kind of like it, but I'm not sure that I would $414 like it. It's in Vancouver, though.
Nifty. It reminds me a little bit. There's a system called the Dimension 68000, which you may be aware of, which is a 68000-based machine that's built physically like a PC desktop, but it has, you know, insertable cards for like CPM Z80, Apple II. I think it had IBM PC, and I think another one. And it was, when it booted up, it had its own thing. It did a 68000-based operating system of their own creation, but they were marketing it in such a way that the appeal really was for people that wanted to run multiple existing platforms. Uh-huh. But yeah, it's interesting. It kind of reminds me of that, although the Dimension was... I've heard of that and seen that in many different places. Right. This I'd never, you know, never, ever before. So.
This really does look like a cheap clone. But...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's see. I will skip the joke one. This is a fairly quick, there's an auction for some soft talks. So we've talked a fair amount about.
Love that name.
It's usually, they're not super, I think the market has fallen down a little bit since they've been available in PDF on the Internet Archive. But they're nice to have. I mean, they're fun to hold in your hand, and this is not particularly expensive. It's a starting bid of $46. It has 25 of the magazines, so I think it's not all, but it's close. I think there were only like 39 or something total.
That would be nice to have. That would be a nice set to
have. They look like they're in pretty good shape. And there's one of them that there's a duplicate of, so you can accidentally spill coffee on one and still have that.
Though if you want Soft Top magazines, you can get them for free at Kansas Fest most years. There'll be piles and piles of them, and you can just take what you want.
Yeah, that's true.
2010, I love that movie. That was one of the covers.
Oh, yeah, that was actually the final one. The last issue. It's really thin. So
it's amazing the difference they went from thin to massive to back to thin.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Now, what is next? Oh, yeah, there's a Mac portable bag. I don't actually think that this doesn't seem like it's too expensive. It was $25. I'll show that again. But
these come up quite a bit, but usually for more than that. It's typically more in the 60 to 150 range kind of thing. So
this is $25.
That's a good price.
That's what I was thinking. The shipping is a little expensive, but that's kind of a bulky thing. And one of the comments that I wanted to make about it is that they absolutely, everyone I have ever seen, like I have never seen one that has all 4 feet. So they always lose
feet.
This one has three of them. I think I have one that has, I have two of these bags, and I think neither of them have all 4 feet on them.
Do you have 4 feet between the two bags?
I might. I can't remember if I have any on one of them, but.
One day you'll see 1 foot on eBay for $150.
But they're kind of nice. I mean, they're somewhat hard side bags, and they fit the portable perfectly. So
You could get a little printer and laptop and make your own Brady Writer 2 with that.
Right.
As we all want them.
Yeah.
Okay, and then I guess the last one that I had that of note here, I guess, is, I think we've talked about this before, but it just came across my search. It's a little booklet called A Personal Guide to Personal Computers that Apple put out, basically just trying to talk about the decision of getting computers and what, you know, and to cast Apple in a good light, but to kind of like talk about the issues that there were. And, you know, so it looks like, apparently it's got some writing in it and stuff. It looks like it's a...
That cover image really wants to be from a Beatles movie. Like, holy yellow submarine. Apple's just saying, come on, we're called Apple. Look at this picture. Sue us. Do it.
But,
and then they
do. So part of the reason this caught my attention is that there's a little movie, a little documentary. So it's Designing Apple's Personal Guide to Personal Computers. And it's basically just, it's like, I think it was produced for a show that...
Oh, so it's a movie about designing this
guide. Exactly. So there's sort of discussions about like what should go into it and like the rationale for all of these things. And it's actually pretty interesting. It's not long. It's seven minutes. And then I found also this thing, Wired in the Raw number 86, which is the – I think it's different. I don't think it's the same thing that we just saw. No, because the time codes go much later. So it's like –
Is this the making of video of that making of video you showed us a moment ago?
I think that is. I think this is the footage from which they made the video about the book.
I was being funny. That's true.
It sort of is.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
Wow.
That's... So I haven't watched the raw footage actually, but the show was supposed to be called Wired In, never completed series on the technological trends and innovations of the 1980s. In this video, Apple employees continue to plan a personal guide to personal computers. So if you watch this video and think that's kind of interesting, then you can, you know, get the book.
It's Turtles All the Way Up.
And it's $20 buy it now. So I mean, like it's not, this particular one is not much. I've seen them go for more.
That's a good price for
writing all over it, I guess.
That's a decent price, I think.
And then I guess, I'll just say the last one because it's here. I don't know anything about this really. The Joy Board.
I do. I know a lot about it.
Tell me about the Joy Board.
I would have written in for this. So this was a Joy Board. You can stand on it and, you know, you lean and tilt instead of using, like, you know, you're skiing instead of moving the stick left or right. I think it comes with a ski game, you know, sure. Mm-hmm. But, you can use it with anything. It just replaces a joystick for four directions. And I'm wondering if I'm looking for the logo on the box. I don't see it, but it's made by Amiga.
Yeah.
The company. that was building the Commodore Amiga, and they needed money to fund their development. So they started creating some Atari like joysticks and this thing, and to raise money while they were designing and laying out the Amiga, when it was going to be an Atari computer, I believe, or at least that was its first destiny. And interestingly, they wrote a program for it where, and I don't know if they released this, but they had it in-house, and they would compete with each other, and they would sit on the joy board in front of the monitor when it was hooked to an Atari. Mm-hmm. And the goal was to sit, see how long you could balance without triggering one of the, to see how long you could like meditatively sit. And that, because of that little humorous practice and their little game at the Amiga development situation, in the development group scenario, that's where, when the Amiga has a system crash, it's called a guru meditation. And that was named after the game or the action that they would take in sitting and trying to be perfectly still, like meditating like a guru. And so the Amiga error, which ran through all the systems, guru meditation, was directly from this joy board that Amiga made to fund themselves. Yeah. So it's interesting. So that's something I've seen come across. It's big. And the only reason I'd want it is to, you know, that story is, I was a big Amiga guy and still am. So that has appeal. But that's probably the most significant thing about this joy board is the story. So anyway, but yeah, so there's that.
Yeah, I remember, I didn't remember the story, but I did remember that there was a story that somebody made this. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this is, I guess this is, I don't know if it's cheap. It's a $75 starting bid. It still has a week, so there might be time for it. This only says Joy Board and Atari 2600, so they're not giving away the thing that makes it valuable. So it's possible that if you're interested in this, you can sneak
in. They don't know.
Unless, Blake, you want to sneak in, and then we'll edit this out.
No, and I put a link in the document there. And they talk about guru meditation.
In the December 1983 magazine Skiing, it gets a mention that says it's sold for $50. So I was interested, like, what did this go for? So it was, at the time, in 1983, a $50 item, including the pack and cartridge.
Okay.
So yeah, if you go, it shows this little section on the wiki.
Oh, yeah, and it says from Amiga Corp.
See guru meditation?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Nice. Okay, well, so that was a good random choice then of mine.
Indeed.
Okay, but it is, we've made it through all of the eBay items I'd picked.
We have. Well done, us.
So now maybe we can turn to any sort of closing discussions before we go.
In alphabetical order.
Okay, yeah, it seems good. Blake, do you have any sort of closing thoughts you wanted to add, projects you're working on or whatever?
I don't have a lot that I have prepared. I guess I'm going to, we talked about BBSing, and I mentioned how I'm trying to work through a problem I'm having with getting yet another system wired together. And I actually have sketches of the serial port pinouts laying on napkins behind me. So I'm probably going to see if I can finish that. And of course, there is, always No Man's Sky to be played. So gotta squeeze that in. Just little things like that we'll be getting into. So.
Excellent.
And thank you for inviting me. Of course, it was been a great discussion.
Oh yeah, no, thanks for doing it. This is great. Awesome. Now we can stop misquoting you. any sort of closing thoughts, Carrington?
I got nothing. Been doing like no retro things. Work. Big software thing that I'm working on that is due maybe yesterday, week ago, something like that. I don't know. All I know is the deadline has blown past, and I still have a lot to do on it. It is not working. So just coding, but all for modern stuff, alas. But still fun. Love, yay program.
But in Python, you said.
This bit, yeah, a bit of it has to be in Python, and I don't like Python. Okay. So.
Oh, yeah.
The whole triple quote thing. Like, come on, man. What?
I don't think that's cool.
Nobody should use three quotes.
Well, I spend my days developing under cold fusion, so there's something strange for you.
I'm surprised that still exists.
Yes, it's there's a lot of academic and government installed bases, and
I'm doing most of this in Code Warrior. Okay,
I miss Code nice Warrior.
Blood, sweat, and code.
Yeah, I kind of miss Code Warrior too. Actually,
I think we talked about this before, but I didn't really use it very much. But I just love the iconography and stuff. It's just.
Oh yeah.
No, I was a big fan. I leapt on Code Warrior like right away. Mm-hmm. I loved it. Mm-hmm. He's Mac App or whatever before that, and then just like I was like, oh,
Coco OS 10, Coco kind of killed that party.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
I think I still have possibly an unopened one for Palm. I had a Palm Code Warrior development kit, and
oh wow,
oh, nice.
And then, you know, basically, I didn't get around to it, and then everybody folded, so it yep. never seemed worth opening.
Yeah. Yeah. My friend Arnold on Twitter, he. The Macrovers guy, yeah, you know, the guy behind Macrovers. Sure. He did a lot of Code Warrior development, and he had a T-shirt. I think it came mm-hmm. with the Code Warrior. I mentioned it under my breath a minute ago, but it was a T-shirt, and the images were great, and it said blood, sweat, and yep. code. And that was the best shirt. If ever I see one on eBay, whatever its condition, I'm going to buy it and wear it. And then I'll write Cold Fusion under it. Yeah.
But yeah, so for me, work has occupied a lot of time. I'm sort of optimistic still that there's going to be a little bit more time. And I have a new, I believe that I have a new idea for a workflow on podcast editing that is in fact going to speed this up, which is good. Cool. So,
is it don't edit?
It's edit.
That's worked great for my podcast.
It is editing less.
Oh, excellent. I'm a big yeah. advocate.
Also, I think, yeah, it's I do a lot of this in Adobe Audition, and so some of it is just using some of the automated stuff that I never got around to understanding and giving it LUFS targets and stuff. So who knows? It might be even louder in the future, too.
Who knows?
But okay, anyway, so... But as far as retro stuff, I don't think... I mean, like, I think I've received a couple of things, but I haven't done anything with any of it. So, but all right, I think that the clock says it is time to stop.
It so, does.
That is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We now have plenty of space because Blake is not sending it anymore. He's just saying it. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And if you wish, you can write a review on iTunes. And until next time,
Retro Compute!